The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 998. It's the 19th of February, 2018. On the podcast today, Rob Proctor, CEO of Audioboom. Boom is the ticker there. And Rob talks about their intention to acquire Triton Digital Canada for a cash consideration of $185 million. Also on the podcast, Michael Masterman, chairman of W Resources, at WRES, discusses their $35 million loan facility they finalised with BlackRock to fund their La Perla tungsten project in Spain. Also, it's a Monday, so Malky, Oil and Gas Sector Authority, talks about the following companies: Hurricane Energy, Faro Petroleum, Saffron Energy, Rehoboam Resources, United Oil and Gas, Uplands Resources, and Barren Oil. Plus, market analyst with Spreadex, Connor Campbell, talks about companies releasing updates this week, including Dunelm, Serco, and Pearson. And I also have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Rob Proctor, CEO of Audioboom, but that's about to change. Rob, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin.
Yeah, well, do you know what? Not many people saw that app coming. I mean, yesterday there's quite a lot of surprise on social media, and it's been covered in a lot of the press. But before we go any further, give us a headline, Rob. What's happened here?
Well, I think the headline, really, I mean, we're obviously coming together with the guys over at Triton Digital. You know, within their sector, which is combination of three things. They do streaming for pretty much 100% for their kind of like their live delivered broadcasting. They do kind of audio on demand ad serving, so that's either in stream or to pre-recorded audio. And they do metrics, which is, you know, an enormous part of their business. And you know, again, they've got amazing penetration into that market across the US sector. And all three areas of their business are growing worldwide as well. So, you know, they're doing more and more in the UK, they're in Australia, they're in India, they're in Singapore, and you know, kind of right around the globe. So, you know, they're within their sector, they're a really big company. Mm-hmm. On-demand podcasting, as we know, is growing hugely. That isn't really the string that's in their bow at the moment, but obviously all of their clients, and they've got about 16,000 implementations around the world at the moment, are looking for, you know, a platform and a CRM, and also best practice and route for monetization around that. And that's all the stuff that we do. So in terms of, you know, putting two complementary businesses together, different clients, some commonality in clients, but also with the opportunity, you know, really to leverage each other's clients just to sell more of what we both already do. It's a great combination.
Yeah, and just going through the financials on this, so essentially you're acquiring the entire issued share capital of Triton Digital Canada for $185 million, which is around about £134 million. And so to do this, you're raising money, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're obviously well into process at this point. In terms of, you know, submission documents and investor presentations and all of that good stuff. So, you know, we did a little test marketing before Christmas with some of the institutions in London to see what the response would be to the combined entity and all of that. Test marketing went amazingly well. And so, you know, the full roadshow kind of happens over, you know, the next couple of 3 weeks. And while the rest of the other documentation is all being done, and obviously we then have to put it to all of our shareholders for their approval. But I think, you know, we make a really compelling case for why this absolutely makes sense for all of the shareholders. And, you know, obviously I'm a big shareholder in Audioboom. And for new shareholders coming on board. So you know, we think, we hope it's going to be very well received when we put it out to all of our existing shareholders as well.
Well, oddly, I know a lot of people sort of, tweeted and retweeted the sort of RNS, especially coming from Vox there, because it gets notified and they tweeted out and all this stuff and it's shared across social media. But then there's I don't think people understood, some shareholders, what to make of it. They didn't. Like you said, you're going to put it to shareholders now. Explain why it's a good deal to shareholders who are not quite sure, because obviously anything like this is quite complex. But what would you say to them? This is a good deal. How would you explain that?
Well, I think you look at the kind of just the fundamentals of putting the two businesses together. I think we're going to have, the new enlarged, they're going to have revenues of in excess of $40 million a year. That's a real thing. We got the EBITDA that's going to be into double-digit millions as well, straight off the bat, which again has to be a really good thing. When you look at our business model, which is about giving kind of upfront payments to the biggest podcasters and the biggest talent with the most listeners, and then we recoup those upfronts against our media sales and what would be our revenue share with them kind of over the following 6 months. It means we have the scope and scale now because of the cash flow. We can get the biggest podcasters in the world onto our platform, and we can, drive revenues straight off of the back of that. So as we go into this, it's $40-odd million a year revenue. Our size and our scale means that we can accelerate our growth so much faster than we could have done before because we've got more scope. Yeah. I guess the other key thing as well that and people, this is probably the thing to really take note of, and certainly over and above what I've already said, the big motivation for doing this is this industry worldwide, but especially US, is going to consolidate massively over the next 2 to 3 years. I mean, it's typical, startup industry, it's very fragmented, lots of players, everybody's kind of doing okay. Mm-hmm. And everybody's growing okay because the market's growing. It's about consolidation. Through this process, over the next 2 to 3 years, there'll be one or two, potentially three players that emerge as pretty much the only players within that market space. And it happens, it happened in search, it's happening in VR, it happens in all the digital industries. By us coming together now, it gives us the size and the scale that we become the consolidator within the industry. We have an opportunity to consolidate here in the UK, certainly in the US, India and Australia as well, probably Canada as we're looking at, launching out in France and Germany. So we can acquire some of those smaller players that are doing really well in their own particular niche, but are never going to have the size and the scale to really drive forward and be a thing. Yeah. As part of a much larger entity, we can move forward and dominate that market over the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, you've said that all along. You have said for a long time that, in the years to come, it'll be dominated by one or two big players, and you have to become one of those players, otherwise you just get taken out, essentially. And so,
absolutely. I mean, you look at the search industry. You had Yahoo. Yeah. Google came and ate their lunch. You had Lycos and a few other small ones as well. Google moved through and dominated that market. And even with, a company with the size and scale of Microsoft moving into that space with Bing, they've not even been able to dent it. Yeah. Once you get to that size and scale, I mean, the barriers to entry for anybody else coming in trying to do what you do just become insurmountable. And we as a company, Audio Boom, and now the new enlarged, we have to be that company that does that thing. And we've got the size and scale now to be able to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when do you envisage this all happening and coming back to the market? What time period does this take? How long does it take?
Well, there's obviously, a set process, and I'm no expert on that. But obviously we've got, Allenby, who have done an amazing job for us. And we've also got Zeus and Senkos now on our ticket. So, arguably we've got, three of the best in the city that are now all over this and working with us, which is great. So I think we've probably got, in reality, it's a 5 to 6 weeks process from here. I mean, we're well down the road. Obviously, the people that currently own Triton. We have an agreement that we're moving forward and we're doing that. We're doing all the paperwork. We've got a million sets of lawyers for all of the different parties and the different brokers, accountants, auditors, all of those guys. And then we have the set process. Obviously, we have to put it to our shareholders, the 40-day period in there and all of that. So I would expect, and obviously there's no guarantee of this because, you know, stuff does happen and things move around, but I would expect we're probably looking at the back end of March, and it may go into the first week in April, but again, you know, it could go longer than that. Everything could just be plain sailing and we could, you know, potentially be a tad shorter, but probably around the end of March would be my best guess, but that is only a guess.
Yeah, and as far as you're concerned, like you said, this is a sort of step one of the growth strategy by acquisition, is it? I mean, is plenty more you see happening over the next couple of years?
And potentially even sooner than that. So, I mean, we've identified targets, and you've got to speak to people, and maybe they do, or maybe they don't want to be acquired, and all of that good stuff. But we've identified targets in Australia and India, certainly in the UK, and most definitely, obviously, in the US, both on the metric side of our business, which is just massively important. And probably worth spending a second or two on the metric side of this as well. Yeah. So in podcasting, you know, it's a $300 million industry, probably $350 maybe million dollar industry this year in the US. Mm-hmm. And that's all being done by face-to-face ad sales. So, you know, it's very hard to scale that as an industry. When we look over the other side of the wall and we look at the US radio industry, you know, that's a $19 billion industry. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's so big is because media planner buyers can buy airtime, can buy slots effectively, directly off of systems that they have within their agencies, media planning buying agencies, that are driven by metrics. So the only way that podcasting can become a billion-dollar industry is if we can aggregate all of those metrics and all of those podcasts and get them onto that same system in the media agencies. So agencies can just buy directly in real time. They don't need meetings. You're not negotiating. Here's the inventory. It costs that. Yeah, I want to advertise in Cincinnati, or I want Florida, or I want whatever I want. Triton are already on those systems for all of the streaming audio for radio stations across the US. I think there is a massive opportunity to aggregate the podcast world with a standard set of metrics for everybody. And we all know podcast metrics, different companies report different things. If we can standardize that and bring all of that onto those same stewardship systems where Triton already are, then podcasting becomes a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah. Excellent stuff. All right, Rob, well, listen, you know, people can still hit that follow button on your page, and I assume you've got some exciting news coming out in the next 6 to 12 months. So if someone's listening to this now and they're not following the story, but, you know, you think they should, then give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list.
I'll give you one quick reason. Audio Boom and now the new enlarged group has the size and scale and scope to be the dominant player in our space globally over the next 18 months to 2 years. So, you know, if you were, you know, 10 years ago looking to buy stocks, let's say in a Google or in one of those other companies that have gone on to dominate their space in whatever sector it is, mm-hmm. I think we have the opportunity to be that company now.
Wow. So, you are going to be the Google of audio, is that right?
Well, yeah, but obviously, you know, the podcast industry is going to be smaller probably than the search industry.
Yeah.
But, you know, within our sector, and you can look at all the different sectors, one company will win out. We have the opportunity to be that company now because we've got the size and the scale to be able to do it. And with that US footprint that we've now got into virtually 100% of every US radio station, over 10,000 of them, mm-hmm. we instantly have the scale now.
Rob, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Let's hope it doesn't take that long and we can you can update the market again. So thanks for coming on, fella.
All right, brilliant. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Michael Masterman, Chairman of W Resources. That's W-R-E-S. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Great to be on, Justin.
And I would say you've hit a significant milestone in your development there of W Resources, and we'll get to that, the details of that in a bit. Before we do, Michael, for people listening who've not heard of the company, explain to them what W Resources is all about, please.
Okay, so W Resources is a leading European tungsten mine developer. We're developing the large-scale tungsten and tin La Perla mine in southwestern Spain. We have just fully financed this mine with a loan facility from BlackRock for $30 million US dollars. And we are proceeding very quickly with our other projects with very good tungsten assets and copper assets and gold assets in Portugal.
Yeah. Well, let's go into this. You teased there on BlackRock, giving you a $35 million loan facility. And now, obviously, if people are not aware, BlackRock are the big boys, aren't they? You know, so that's quite a name to drop there.
So BlackRock, as I think most of your investors would know, is the one of the largest institutional funds in the world. I think it's got something like $5 to $6 trillion under management. It also is one of the leading experts in the resource space, with major positions in most of the global mining companies.
Okay, so this $35 million loan, how far will this go? What's it intended to be used for? When will sort of the mine be built then, Michael?
Okay, so we closed the financing, satisfied all the conditions precedent on Thursday. The money was in the bank on Friday, and we are using the funds to develop the La Perla mine. So it's a $35 million facility. We require $28 million US dollars to develop the La Perla mine, and we have got the La Perla mine to a position where, on the receipt of these funds, which was literally Friday, we can move very decisively and very purposefully to complete La Perla over the next 12 months. There'll be lots of news flow, lots of progress, lots of site visits for those shareholders who are keen to come down to Spain. This is exactly what the company needed to take it to the next stage of capitalization and financial strength.
Yeah, and this is one of the big stumbling blocks for junior resource companies is acquiring funding to get that mine built. And so you've done that. So that's now the big hurdle out the way. So let's say you're going to start constructing the mine in 12 months' time. You'll start producing. So take us through
over the 12 months, not in 12 months' time.
Yeah, over the 12 months.
We're literally the operations and project execution team has been working extraordinarily hard with really sensible use of the capital that we've had to make sure at the point in time where the pin drops on the financing, which we're able to achieve on Thursday, they're ready to go. So we're not getting the financing and then sitting around saying, what are we going to do? We have the three core execution projects to build the plant let. The Metso crusher equipment arriving on site in April. All the engineering on the jig and the concentrator is very advanced. And we're not resting on our laurels with what is a very significant milestone for the company, the $35 million financing from BlackRock. We're getting on and delivering what BlackRock wants to see, low-cost, large-scale tungsten production, and what shareholders want to see. So huge alignment between securing the financing, delivery of the project, and we're very focused on and very clear on what we need to achieve.
Marvellous. Well, let's say it all goes to plan now, Michael, in the next 12 months, and you're up and running and ready to produce. What is hopefully the output there, the production numbers? Take us through that, if you could.
Okay, so the project goes in two phases. The phase that we're building at the moment is called T2, which is 2 million tonnes of run-of-mine feed to the crusher, producing 2,700 tonnes per annum of tungsten concentrate and around about 300 tonnes per annum of tin. Tungsten prices are up well above our financial model expectations. Tin prices are up to 21,000, 22,000 a tonne. So we're in a very good, strong market for these commodities. We have a vastly lower capital expenditure than any other tungsten property in the world to get our project into production. And we have very low operating costs. So this is a very good time to secure the finance and be extremely well prepared to execute the project.
Yeah, obviously there's lots of moving parts, but what type of cash flow, how much cash flow are you hoping to generate there, Michael?
So as I said a moment ago, there's two phases, the T2 phase and the T3.5 phase. The expansion to 3.5 million tonnes per annum of ROM is a relatively straightforward capital investment, and that'll occur in about year two or year three. From the T2 phase, we're looking at kicking out an EBITDA of the order of around about $20 million US dollars per year of earnings before interest and tax. So that's a very strong earnings base. We lift that even further when we move to the T3.5 stage. Mm-hmm. So we'll go there as sensibly as the market and our own activities can deliver. Loan facility, capital investment, significant revenue, significant earnings flowing from this project.
Excellent stuff. Well, Michael, if someone's listening to this and likes the sound of the progress you're making there and the fact that you're heading towards production point, then and they're not following the story, please give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay. Well, number one, we're funded by BlackRock. We have $35 million of non-dilutive financing in place. Number two, we have the La Perilla development fully underway with this financing, and there's going to be lots of news flow and lots of activity supporting the company. And finally, we have a great set of tungsten, copper and gold projects that will quickly follow La Perilla into production, and that's going to give a lot more upside to shareholders over and above the very strong returns that will come from La Perilla.
Marvellous stuff. Michael, like I say, it's going to be a busy year for you. Lots of news flow, so hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thanks, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Malky, Oil and Gas Sector Authority. Are you all right, Malky? How's Monday morning for you?
Yeah, I'm very well indeed. It's Monday morning, a bit cold and overcast, but it's not freezing today, so not so bad, Justin. And you?
Yeah, not too bad. Well, on the weekend, it seemed to be thawing out. Winter seemed to be losing its battle a little bit. But then I was listening to the radio this morning, and they said it's going to get colder this week. I checked out the Thursday. Did I hear that correctly? I checked out the weather. It's going to get really cold by the end of the week. And I thought, what? Winter's not giving up yet. It's going out with a fight.
I don't think it is. No. Yeah, and so I've got a bit of travelling coming up, so our next couple of weeks will be different timings, I think, but one in cold weather and one in warm weather, so let's see how it goes.
Yeah, okay, well, listen, I just mentioned you. Three of the top risers today are oil stocks. I've got United Oil and Gas, i3 Energy and Upland Resources, so it's looking quite nice on the oil front, quite bullish for me anyway. But what's happening, Malky, as far as oil stocks?
Well, there are a few things going on. I mean, I'll mention that one or two of those ones later on, because the fact that Barren Oil has farmed into the going into the WIC prospect is very exciting for, you know, all those punters in there. So I'll mention Carelian and Rare Bold Resources and so on. And Barren Oil is looking good on the back of that this morning. But now this morning I'm going to talk about a number of stocks where news is out in the last few days, or when I've met with people and so on. I'll talk about Hurricane and Faro, obviously Saffron, which is about to become Coro, let's have a word about Rarebold and so on at the end. So the good news for Hurricane shareholders last week, if you remember, I went over to Dubai to check on the FPSO, the Aoka Mizu, mm-hmm. which is being upgraded, repaired, and having its life extended in the Dubai dry dockyards. I was pretty impressed by the operation there. I've seen a few of these places, and they can be pretty mixed. Mm-hmm. But what you do want to see is a big, busy dockyard with a lot of high-quality people in it and some decent kit. The most important thing last week, they announced that the process to complete the buoy, the dry trials for the buoy, which are being done by Blue Water and obviously Dubai Dry Docks, have worked successfully. The important thing there is that it should be good for the offshore hookup. The thing is, they test everything in dry conditions. Mm-hmm. And when they've done that, they should find that it works when they go offshore. So I'm pretty positive that means that they should be good to go for the hookup when they engage it with a turret offshore. So that is now about a week ahead of schedule. And it means that the sail away of the Okamizu from Dubai, which is scheduled for the third quarter of this year, is very much on target. When I went to see it, I thought it might actually be ahead of schedule, but wouldn't want to jump the gun. But they're doing a very impressive job there, and you know, we know that they've got first oil targeted for the first quarter of next year. So mm-hmm. I think the Hurricane shareholders should be pleased. You know, there was always a worry that you wouldn't get too much news out of this company for the whole of this year, but the good news is coming through, and. You know, I expect further news from the dockyards and so on in the next few months.
Yeah, okay, marvellous. Well, that will be welcome for shareholders because, like you said, exactly as you said, I thought that. I mean, there's going to be a long gap, I thought, without any news, but obviously there has to be things to be done before they start pumping or going for the oil. So, extra stuff. What's next, Marky? Go on.
A lot of kit being put in there, and I'm really positive that it's going well.
All right, fella, what's next?
I wanted to talk about Faro, because Faro is, I always call it a sort of poster boy of the sector after Ithaca left, and they are, you know, without doubt, one of the best managed, best operations in the sector. Mm-hmm. They've got a two-day analyst visit in Norway this week, which unfortunately, due to previous board commitments, I'm unable to attend this time, but they do very, very well when they present their annual shindig in Norway, and so their Stavanger office will be, I think it's tomorrow and Wednesday. But the bottom line is that they made two announcements last week, effectively. One was that they are, they'd sold their excess part of Fenja to Suncorp for $50+ million, which is extremely good. I mean, this is a big play, and they've got a number of really, really good prospects and developments up there, obviously Brasse, and they'll keep it down to the same around the same amount of percentage as those other ones, including that means that the capex will come down quite a lot. The Suncor will pay their capex, so that comes down from 230 to 70 or something million. So it's extremely good, and it keeps the cost down, but it keeps a really decent finger in that particular pie, and I think that they'll continue to do well. The bottom line is that the things are going very well at Faro. The day after, or a couple of days after that, they had the operational update and guidance for this year. It goes from strength to strength, this company. Production at the end of last year was exactly in line, if not towards the top end of expectations, and guidance for this year is similarly good. I'm expecting that to do very well. They've got a decent increase in reserves, I think 20% increase in 2P reserves. This company is fully funded for all the developments, including things like the Brasse and so on, and the associated new projects, and of course fully funded for what is a pretty exciting drilling campaign. They've got a really good portfolio, primarily in the Norwegian North Sea and in that neck of the woods, obviously some UK as well, but their exploration and development is fully funded. It's cash generating, they've got decent production And at $60, they're looking in very good form. They're probably the most successful longer term, over the longer period, driller and exploration company, and they've taken it into development. So very, very strong. Pharaoh, you know, has been a bit quiet recently, but as I say, with a two-day analyst visit this week, should be good news.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. FPM is the ticker there. What's next, Marky?
Well, Safran returned last week. You probably noticed.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah.
And I think that, you know, that was good. It was obviously good news for everybody because you know, the shares, which had been quiet enough and then suspended for some time, returned. They returned at around 5p, which is very positive, which is above the level of the open offer, which is coming up. And I think that Safran, which on the 9th of April will become Korra, and I think that we expect some very exciting things there. Now, you remember that this is Korra will end up being the holder of all the Italian interests of Sound Energy, plus Safran, plus Po Valley. But they've announced that it'll be a pan-European / Southeast Asian vehicle. And that's very exciting for shareholders because the experience that that James Parsons has got there is extensive, having been there before, and of course initially where Sound were. They've announced a new director on the board, which is Ilham Habibi, who I met last week at the Korra launch, and he's a very smart, highly respected local businessman. Indeed, he's the son of the president of Indonesia who brought democracy to the country.
Wow.
He's a very highly rated man, and I was extremely impressed by him. So I expect Korra to quite swiftly make some announcements about acquisitions. They're going to be probably remaining in the sort of gas play that the Sound, Echo, Korra plays are going to be. There's some very, very swift developments can be done in Indonesia and that part of Southeast Asia. So I would expect it to be gas with some exploration, probably onshore or close to onshore. There's a lot of offshore, which is only in a few feet of water over there. Mm-hmm. And as I say, Indonesia is probably a good a place to see as any. This company is also fully funded. It's as you can see, they raised $14 million with their cornerstone investor, which is CIP Merchant Capital, which is an offshoot of Continental, and so they've got the excellent Marco Fumagalli on board, and they're also doing this, as I say, this $2 million open offer underway at the moment. So over the next few weeks, all the technicals will be done, and the by mid-April it'll be Korra.
Yes, exciting moves there.
Obviously, we've got, this is part of the, you know, Sound Energy, then Echo Energy, now Korra Energy. And exciting prospect. A lot of exposure for retail in retail holders here.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. And what else are you chatting about, Marky?
I was going to mention the sort of Rehobold thing.
Go on.
Obviously, Rehobold is an exciting play, especially with the retail. They've got a lot of institutions in there now as well, which is good. But there was a lot of chat in the last two or three weeks about the private company, which is called Corellian, which you remember Rehobold took a 35% stake in just at the back end of last year. The Rehobold people wanted to get the exposure into things like the Coulter prospect in the south of the UK and the Wick prospect in the North Sea. We knew that Corellian was raising money, and Rehobold announced that they would keep their exposure to Corellian and therefore participate in that rights issue, as it was. The market was saying, obviously, it's very good news that that Rehobold are keeping their exposure to those prospects, and of course the fact that they're going to get on and drill, probably they're hoping to drill Coulter in April of this year, and Wick in early autumn. So there'll be some exciting things to go. One or two people said that Rehbold, having made two or three other investments, would not have enough money to therefore to participate in the Karelian rights and do other things. Well, I spoke to Steve Williams last week, and he and Sachin are highly confident that they can invest in not only this fundraise, but obviously they've got a pipeline of opportunities, and they'll certainly be enabled to invest in further ones. The feeling is that Rehbold will at some stage raise some more money, and Williams and Ozar are absolutely convinced that if they do, they won't do it at the wrong price. I think Rehbold shareholders might have been concerned that they would have a sort of, you know, big deep discount rights issue. Absolutely no chance. The company has got enough good quality supporters who will raise money at the right price. They appreciate the value that is in the Rehbold company, and that there won't be a heavily discounted rights issue or anything like that. Rehbold can do it either way. They can either stay with the sort of stable of investments that they've got already, which are very good indeed, and sit tight on working capital as it is at the moment. Or, you know, if they're given money at the right price by institutions, and then they'll give the opportunity for existing shareholders, they'll do that as well. Mm-hmm. So I think you've got the put and the called with Rehbold. And you'll notice this morning, interestingly, that and one of the announcements this morning is that Barren Oil have said that they are farming into the Wick prospect. This Wick prospect is becoming one of the most exciting potential prospects for the second half of the year in the North Sea. Mm-hmm. Things like that have gone very well. So other people who are in Wick are beginning to beef up as well. So yeah, a lot of excitement around Karelian, Rehbold, and the Wick prospect, and obviously Barren Oil now, and others who are in there as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you know what? That's the end of this year. I mean, do you know what? I do like the strategy of, like I said, you know, oil and gas, which they've just taken on a guy here. Let me just check up the ex-Tullow. I mean, they are ex-Tullow team anyway, and they seem to have ambitions of Tullow, but they've also signed another guy from Tullow. What's his name? Mr. Graham Martin. And he was central to that sort of Tullow sort of from 1987 to 2016, you know, the movement, the really impressive scale. It went from almost nothing to a FTSE 100 company, which is, you know, by any standard, amazing growth, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And they'll do some exciting things. I'm looking forward to catching up with United Oil and Gas. Brian Larkin has been on the case a few times to me, and as soon as I get back from my travels, I'll be getting to meet with him and see some exciting things. I mean, as I say, they've got some exciting prospects, as I say, with Wick, with Karelian and so on. So, and of course, ironically, they're in that exciting Po Valley discovery that we talked about a few weeks ago, which is part of Coro now, so...
Yeah, exactly. They're all interlinked here, mate. It's like one big family.
Yeah, it looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Excellent, Malky. Thanks for that. And is that it for this week?
That's all for this week, I think. I think we've covered everything we want to there.
Marvellous. What's your thoughts on oil generally? I know, I mean, because let's be honest, we've gone through a period where when oil was like dipping down to, I think, intradays at 23, 28 bucks, whatever it was, and then it stayed low for a while. And, you know, it always happens, there's lack of investment in exploration from the majors and all that when times like this happen, because they have to pay dividends and, you know, it's a bit like Royal Dutch Shell do not want to cut the dividends. So, I mean, do you see this feeding through in the next year or so where there'll be a lack of oil coming online on stream?
Well, I think this is what's one of the reasons the oil price has picked up the way that it did. You know, a number of people stayed very, very pessimistic about the second half of last year. And if you remember, the reason that I was banging on about the fact that I thought the oil price would pick up There were two reasons there. First of all was that the OPEC and Saudi alliance and so on, I'll come back to that. But the second reason was that when things went horribly wrong, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years, before the oil price picked up, so 14, 15, 16, what happened was is that almost everybody cut back their capex. Mm-hmm. And these things take, you know, minimum of 5 years to come through. So there's me saying that, you know, we are going to lose production that is coming through in 2022 and 2023 and 2024. And that's exactly what's happening. People are looking further out and finding that there's less oil around because there was no capex for 3 years while the oil companies continued to to pay their dividends and not, you know, hunker down, as it were.
Yeah.
The interesting one, the best two of all are Total and Shell. But the interesting thing is that at the time, Shell were already committed to buying BG. So what eventually they did was they decided to take a deep breath, buy BG, and cut back heavily in other parts of the business. And of course, they bought one of the best oil and gas companies in the world at the bottom of the oil price for absolute chips. So they've come out of it, you know, in a much stronger position than most.
Yeah.
So that's why they're strong. And of course, you know, I happen to think that the oil price will stay, you know, in the 60 to 70 range at the moment. I think that we had a bad sort of 10 days because, you know, the oil price got a bit overdone. It got up to 72, and people said, oh, you know, at 72 we start losing demand. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think the most important thing is that whatever happens in the US with all this, this US oil, the shale that's coming on stream and so on, people are getting very worried about it. You know, I'm not so worried about that. I think that they don't control, you know, any barrels. If the oil price comes down, they'll just stop producing straight away because it's not, you know, it's not profitable at $50 or $55. So that will come down.
Yeah.
And Saudi Arabia and Russia in particular, but obviously all the OPEC and non-OPEC agreements have sensibly worked out that if they can keep their adherence to their quotas, they will keep the oil price at the higher level. I think that they, you know, don't forget, as you said, it was 27 at one stage. Mm. Well, it's February 2016, and it rallied off that very, very sharply. At the time, I think they were hoping that they could get 40 or 50.
Yeah.
The fact that it's now between 60 and 70, I mean, most of the OPEC countries and Russia would obviously prefer to be higher, but they don't want to take out the demand. And at the moment, one of the good things about the way the supply and demand is working is that because we've got this good market, we talked about it last week, the good market in, you know, the economies in the States and China and India are actually all doing very well. And so that creates a bigger demand for crude oil anyway. So, I think that they're happy to keep it in the 60 to 70 range.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't want it to run away too high too quickly.
Yeah, I see, yeah. I mean, it does seem like a lot of the time. I mean, we do see, OPEC and Russia trying to limit production, but it's the old adage, isn't it, really? It does come down to price and,
The key thing about this, Justin, is that it really does come down to price. And the point is that they can control this marginal barrel. They can cut back production as much as to say, right, there isn't any oil in the marketplace and the price is whatever you like. But if they work out that they cut back, they all OPEC and non-OPEC, including Russia, cuts back by 10%, and they get a 25% increase in the price, which is what they've done, it makes a lot of sense. They just need to stick to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's the thing. Stick to it, guys. It makes sense. Marvellous, Malky. Thanks for that, fella. And we'll speak next week.
It's my pleasure, Justin. Thanks very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me right now is Connor Campbell, market analyst with Spreadex. You all right, Connor?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent stuff. Well, listen, you're my eyes and ears on the bigger capped stocks, the bigger companies, and you're looking at results coming out this week. So who have you cast your keen eye over? Which companies, Connor?
First up, we've got Dunelm on Tuesday. It hasn't done too great recently, but its figures For a retailer in the UK, its figures have been very, very strong. Its first quarter figures back in October. I think this was back when it didn't even have a CEO, because it had that weird thing last year where it parted ways with its CEO due to a clash of styles, I think, was the reason given. And it took them a while to replace that role. But even without a CEO at the helm, I think for the first quarter, total sales were up nearly 25% to 47.9 million. Like-for-like sales were even almost arguably more impressive. They were up 9.3% to 214.3 million, which are really, really healthy figures for a UK retailer, given the issues that sector has had in the last, I guess, year or so, really. Second quarter figures in January, arguably just as strong, given that it covered sort of the more competitive or at least tougher comparatives of the Christmas period. Total sales are up 13.6% to just shy of 300 million. Like-for-likes are up 3.4%. And especially good for Dunelm was online like-for-like sales are up 30.5% to 26.2 million. So obviously showing progress there. They've really upped their online offerings in the last few months, the last year or so. So they're clearly seeing a lot of success on that side. I think it wasn't greeted with too much cheer from investors. I think they were disappointed by the fact that its gross margin fell 180 basis points. That was due to sort of lower margin sales at Weld stores, which I think it bought at the end of 2016, and a focus on sort of the newness, a focus on newness in its range, sort of ate into the bottom line. But, you know, very healthy figures. In terms of its half-year figures, which it reports on Tuesday, it's already said that I think like-for-like sales, total like-for-like sales for the half-year are up 6%, which is very strong, whilst total sales are up 18.4% to £545 million. As I said, it was on track to deliver good full-year profit growth, but that with a slight reduction in first half profit, I think largely due to the consolidation of World Store's losses. So I think the reaction on Tuesday is really going to be dependent on the size of that reduction, like how much has first half profit pulled back year on year. Yeah. In terms of our clients, though, they're buying at the 650 mark. I think they're happy with Dunelm. You know, it seems to have not had any real issues where some of its peers may have had. So yeah, clients buying around the 650 mark.
Yeah, do you know what? I bought this at Lowe's around at the fifth. Where was it? I saw a support level and I bought it around about. I was quite early in here, 570, and it rallied up and I just took 10% and I got up. But it went a lot further. And I'm not into big stocks a lot. I don't invest in big stocks a lot because they're not the return, really. But unless you obviously spread betting, a lot of people on SpreadX do that. There's a lot more return you can get leverage there. But you know, I took it out, but it rallied quite strongly. It went down to about 550, and then went to 760. I was out way too early on that, but it's since come back, like you say, Drummond, and now it's looking like £6.650 is a good support level. But, the chart is looking good. I mean, let's be honest, a couple of years back, it was up over 10 quid, pretty much, but now it's down at nearly half that. So there we are. But, you know, it's retail, and it's very competitive. You have to have a point of differentiation, don't you, really? A point of difference, you know, from other retailers to perform strongly. But like you said, maybe that's all priced into the chart right now. Cool. Anything else you'd get, Connor?
Yeah, on Thursday, then we've got Serco Group. Obviously, one of those stocks that has sort of been caught in the Carillion and Capita crossfire since 2018 began.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but just thinking there is opportunity there, you know? There's a lot of companies now sort of being tarred with the same brush that aren't the same, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Sector-wide, like, ripple of fear sent through the sector, dragged it lower, despite nothing, at least in 2018, really coming out to suggest it should have fallen as sharply as it has. It also, it also had a very, very bad 2017, so I think it fell 31%. Despite at the very end of the year, there being signs that things were starting to turn around for the company. I think in December was its last update. I think it said that its order intake for the year was at £3 billion. Its book-to-bill ratio had crossed 100%, I think, for the first time since 2012. It also said that underlying, it's like 2017, underlying trading profit was expected to be around the top end of its, I think, 65 million to 70 million guidance. Said that would rise to 80 million in 2018 and then further good growth in 2019. So things do seem to be looking up for the company. Obviously, then 2018 hit and all the Carillion stuff has sort of marred what was the strong turnaround news at the end of 2017. However, there was some good news. I think it was on Valentine's Day that Serco said that, you know, it was buying, it announced after Carillion collapsed that it was buying some healthcare contracts from Carillion for, I think, $47.7 million. On Valentine's Day, it announced that it got that price down to $29.7 million. So, that, you know, that's a decent bit of saving on those healthcare contracts, and shows that, you know, it sort of knows what it's doing. It's feeling confident. It's, you know, managing to take advantage of this, the sort of the rocky performance of its peers, something that should, I guess, only continue as the year goes on and a bit more competition is removed from the market. So from our clients' perspective, they're quite strongly buying, but like around that sort of 85p, 90p mark.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It looks definitely like it's been oversold for a long time, doesn't it? It's come from a great height. And let me just, SRP is a ticker, isn't it? I just lost my chart here when I'm chatting to you. But yeah, so going back, okay, it's 87 pence now, like you say, 150 not so long ago. And do you know what? They're like a good support level. It's bounced up this level before. I'm at 80 pence. So we'll see. Anything else, fella?
Yeah, finally, we've got Pearson on Friday. Another stock that, it sort of, it had a very rocky 2017, but actually didn't do too badly given sort of the barrage of bad news, especially in the first half of 2017. I think it ended up falling 9.6% over the year, which, given that it fell, I think, 29% in the first 3 weeks of 2017 alone, you know, shows that it managed to recover quite strongly in the second half of the year. I think more recently, its January update, again, sort of taking it off of those sort of recent highs. The main issue was that its US division, it's been an issue for a while now, so much so that I think in last May's AGM, when it floated the idea of selling its US division, that caused the stock to quite sharply rise. I think the main issue is sort of in the US education sector. It said weak textbook sales and cautious buying behavior due to lower enrollment in US colleges and things like more open resources online dragged the North America division down, revenue in the North America division down 4%. They had underlying total revenue down 2% as well for the 9 months to the end of 2017. However, it did say that for the full year, its adjusted operating profit would come in at the top end of expectations, I think between £600 million and £605 million, compared to the previous, I think £575 million to £606 million guidance. And that, you know, that was a bit of good news that sort of got lost in the shuffle, really, due to the weakness of its American division. So I think on Friday, it'll be, if it can hit that £605 million target, then there is room for it to bounce back, given that it's sort of steadily declined. Obviously, part of that's also going to be due to sort of the wider market decline since 2018 began. What is interesting is actually our clients don't seem convinced with Pearson at the moment. While there are a few buyers, the majority of our clients interested in Pearson are actually selling around the 680 mark. Yeah. So they clearly don't have a lot of confidence in Pearson meeting that profit guidance on Friday.
Yeah, well, do you know what? There's a good support there. There's several gaps in the chart. It's gapped up from this level at 650. But if it breaks that, it's going to go down. I mean, the next sort of level of support there is around about, 565. So it's, so if it doesn't hold 650, hold on to your hats. Marvellous, Connor. Good to chat to you. And we'll speak next week.
Talk next week. Thanks very much.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Kibo Mining. At four, Barron Oil. At three, Active Energy Group. At two, Upland Resources, UPL. At one, United Oil and Gas. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Great Western Mining. That's Holdings and Company. At four, Infrastrata, Infa, Director Shareholding, Grant of Share Options. At three, Union Jack Oil, Holmwood Well Update and Environment Agency Permit. At two, Extract Resources, that's Manika Hard Rock Collaboration Agreement. And number one was from United Oil and Gas, board appointment. Ex-Tello guy joins the Ex-Tello team there at United Oil and Gas. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs. in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz, discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT Weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.